Hi, and welcome to The Reading Revolution. I'm your host, Josh Gregory. We've got a great episode today as we do a little bit of history. Joining me are Barbara Irwin, Tony Bettino Sr., and Pam Johnson. We're going to be talking about creating Reading Rainbow. The Reading Revolution starts now.
Are you ready to embark on an adventure through the world of words? Join us on The Reading Revolution, and let's explore the exciting world of literacy together.
Barbara, Tony, Pam, thank you so much for being on The Reading Revolution. We appreciate your time.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So as I am so want to say on this radio, so as I am so want to say on this podcast, let's start at the start. We can throw the name Reading Rainbow out there, and everyone who hears this or sees this is going to say, oh, yes, I know exactly what that is. But I would guarantee a lot of them do not know the origin and the genesis of this program. If we can really go way back and talk about how the Reading Rainbow started, that would be an awesome way to kick things off.
Well, if you go really way back, I graduated from Ithaca College in television production and radio, got hired by Channel 17, moved up the ladder to producer, director, and then they came to me with this idea of how would I like to be involved in instructional television? And I said, sure. It was worth probably $10 more a week, so I was willing to do that. So I did not know much about instructional television. So I started doing some marketing and awareness about using television as a teaching tool in the schools, because we were servicing the schools at that time in the Western New York area. That was our target. So I got involved with some marketing ideas and kept those over the few years, and finally came up with the idea of focusing on one particular area. And my committee in 1977 voted on focusing on the area of reading. So we started a process of looking towards how do you combine television and reading? They really didn't go together in those days. I mean, librarians and reading teachers were pretty much telling their kids, don't watch TV, you know, read a book. So the process was for us to work with teachers and reading librarians to develop some program. And then as a parent, I came across the idea of the television lost the phenomenon, summer phenomenon. And I said, but this is when, you know, kids don't read, and when they go back to school, teachers need to take a few weeks to get them back up to where they're supposed to be. And I said, after being in television and learning that there's definitely something we could do about this. I was so adamant that television could help the problem, the summer reading gap. And we started developing different ideas that maybe we'll go through in the podcast here, but because it became a process. It was just a process of starting somewhere, not knowing where we would end up, to tell you the truth. So we began with some summer ideas, ran a program called Studio C, and then got involved with another summer program the following year. So That was the beginning. You asked when it began. I'd say 1977 when we found out that, and then these two people were involved also. So they might have some thoughts on that too.
I was thinking, you know, it's the time of public media's birth, right? In all the states, right? And so, you know, Tony was beginning his career literally as the channel 17 was getting established here in Buffalo. And, you know, the nature of television was in its infancy, right? A lot of live on air specials, a lot of live specials. I mean, yeah, were they taped, Tony? No, they were live. Many of them.
I was on camera for those shows here.
Yeah, live television with, you know, nuns and teachers and people who knew science or knew the arts or whatever. And everybody's, you know, teaching on television. So it was like a heyday for the birth of public television. And it was also wonderful because the station was getting more thoughtful about, you know, really listening to its educators. And like each school district would have a representative that was a part of a general assembly, instructional television general assembly. And, you know, these representatives were saying to Tony, help us meet certain needs for our children and so, or for our students. And Tony was very, very wise to have them focus on reading and to get that group of members to think about where the greatest needs were. And they sent him in the direction of reading. And so, you know, lot to think about and a lot to discover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We could talk about the five summers of experimentation that preceded Reading Rainbow.
Yeah, I would love to do that. And I wanted also to kind of tag what Pam was just saying. And, you know, public television being such a different animal in the world of television, where you were allowed to really incorporate so many different voices and really kind of make it a community project, if you will, so much more than commercial television would have ever been able or have that capability of doing.
Right. And Tony mentioned that they didn't set out to create this, you know, what became the spectacular show, Reading Rainbow. They started by addressing a need in the community that they recognized, which was kids aren't reading enough in the summer and teachers have to go back and spend 6 weeks in the fall bringing kids up to the level that they were when they left in June. And Tony's belief that television could do something to help with this, and cultivating a group of believers in the school systems and in libraries that television and books, television reading could work together.
So let's talk a little bit about these summers of experimentation, where obviously trial and error always seems to work when, you know, you're doing the research and development and this is working, this is not working. Let's talk a little bit about that process as well. Really taking the time to refine this idea to get to the unbelievable product that was inevitably to come.
Well, let me take the first summer because that didn't go very well. We used a program called Studio C, and the one reason we used it was that they were able to give away manuscripts for children to pick up or get and read. That was the idea for that. It was not in our target audience. It was for older kids, actually. So that was probably one of the first mistakes we made, but it didn't go well. As a matter of fact, I was discouraged, is probably the better word to say it. I wasn't sure we would go on to a second summer. This, as I mentioned, is a process. So we're thinking about this. I'm saying, well, I don't know, this and that and the other thing. But then I got a letter actually from the library, the Buffalo and Erie County Public Library, Diane Christman. And she, in her letter, she agreed. It didn't go well. We didn't have many students, not a lot of people. We didn't have enough TV sets, this, that, and the other thing. But then she gets into the thing, says, but let's do it again next summer. And I said, well, okay. And towards the end of her letter, she said, we'll be able to bring like 50 libraries into this project by getting TV sets. She was really, I mean, you know, how do you turn something like this down? So based on that, in fact, I think that towards the end of her letter, she said, let me know when the next meeting is for next summer. I said, well, you know, 50 libraries, that's a pretty good start. I really wasn't expecting this kind of response. I was thinking librarians are, you know, they had their system of what they were doing in the libraries, summer reading programs, but she turned it around. She was one of the bigwigs, and she kind of said, I'm going to pretty much submit that we'll do better next year. So that was the pretty much the summer of that one. Maybe Pam or Barb might want to pick up on that.
I was going to ask Barb, what was special about Studio C? Because, I mean, you know, the nature of the show itself, it's a great show. Yes. The TV and outreach part is the part that was a little bit maybe not as well orchestrated or well attended as it could have been. But the show was very special.
The show was developed by South Carolina Educational Television. And it was designed for, as Tony noted, older children, like tweens, 11 to 14-year-olds, or 10 to 14-year-olds. Mm-hmm. And it was shot entirely in the field. Mm-hmm. And it was adventures that showed children of that age doing things. Like, here's a group of 12-year-olds that formed a jazz band. you know, or here's a group of kids who have a, you know, they bake cookies and they have a cookie company, or, you know, let's go to a, let's look at a shipwreck or something like that. So it was taking kids visually through the experience, you know, of television, taking them on these adventures in different parts of the country. And it was a great show. And another thing that's very significant about it is that it was produced by a woman named Cecily Truitt. And Cecily became the producer of Reading Rainbow several years later. So that was what Studio C was. So that was 1978. The first experimental summer here in Buffalo using that. And again, as Tony said, it was not a scripted show, but they created transcripts after the fact and then distributed them in kind of an experiment to see, you know, if we give these transcripts to kids, will they read along with the show? And let's encourage them to do that. Mm-hmm. So that was the first summer of experimenting. The second summer, the second and third summers involved a show called Ride the Reading Rocket. And Tony can say he discovered Ride the Reading Rocket prior to discovering Studio C, mm-hmm. and rejected it and said, we can't show this program. It's too old. It was produced in the mid 60s Evansville, Indiana, and it was, you know, it was meant to help kids read over the summer, and it taught reading lessons essentially, yeah. and there was a puppet and they were on a rocket ship but it was very outdated. So when Tony was looking for a show for the next summer, he came upon Ride the Reading Rocket again. And said, well, maybe we'll go with this. But one of the things that was significant about Ride the Reading Rocket is that it had a workbook to go along with it. And 100 pages, it was pretty hefty. And mm-hmm. and it was geared towards, you know, have your children watch the show, make sure that they are following the lessons day to day. And Buffalo, WNED, spearheaded this. Tony, do you want to pick up a little bit with that?
Well, you know what happened the first year? I mean, we ran it and, you know, I was not impressed, but Pam organized, what was that called? Teddy Bear's Picnic out at the Wilcox Mansion with, you know, people and musicians and storytelling. And I remember a family coming in and with the child. And I knelt down to talk to the child, and she had exactly what Barb's talking about. She had this 100 page book that she had filled in with everything else in the world of it. And the parents said, oh, yeah, we have to make sure that she watched the program. She always wanted to watch the program and do the activity book. And that kind of introduced me and Pam, I think, to the outreach mechanisms that we had. So we ran it the following year. We ran the two summers. So
and Tony, didn't the Buffalo schools themselves, like the reading teachers and the reading department of the Buffalo schools, they used some of their grant money that they had to mm-hmm. help give the activity books, like make them freely available to the Buffalo public school kids. Mm-hmm. So they became more of a partner, an active partner in the second summer of Ride the Reading Rocket. And there was also a professor who had worked with it too, right? Or well, I'm mixing up my research, but in any event, it was more successful because the Buffalo schools got involved and more children and families, you know, actively participated with Ride the Reading Rocket. But there again, too, infancy of instructional television. It was educationally sound, but it needed some upgrading in terms of the style of television. Studio C was much more cool. Ride the Reading Rocket was a little less cool, but it was very educationally sound. It actually had a lot of U.S. Department of Education money in it. So mm-hmm. the people who built it in Indiana, you know, did a very nice job of carefully, thoughtfully building it, but it maybe wasn't as appealing. So the world of public media, Tony, everybody's realizing there's a need, there's a big need, but we don't quite have the right product yet. We don't have the right series yet. So, you know, it's a lot of proving the need for something. And these trials were really important to, you know, building the case, like making the case for something bigger being needed in the world of public broadcasting.
And that's a transition to, I started thinking about what if we had enough money for a good show, what would it entail? And the very first thing on my list was I would need a good host. I wanted somebody like Mr. Rogers. And in fact, I went to see Mr. Rogers and kind of designed a summer program around him, knowing full well that it was a long shot. He was very informative. He was very helpful. And he was Mr. Rogers. And I just thinking, I need somebody like him. I really need somebody like him. I'll lead into Barb. Barb wrote a chapter in the book about Mr. McFeely. Mr. Rogers more or less said, well, I can't do it, but maybe Dave Newell, the Mr. Rogers staff, maybe he'd be interested in doing something. And I'm thinking, well, maybe we'll do something in our studio. And Barb wrote a lot about Mr. McFeely. So you can talk about Barb.
Yeah. So, well, Tony approached, Mike Collins, the president and CEO of WNED PBS, and said, like to do a show. And so Mike budgeted $11,000,
yeah,
for a show. And Tony had established this relationship with David Newell, the actor who played Mr. McFeely. And David was interested in helping out. So David came down to Buffalo and up to Buffalo from Pittsburgh, and he and Tony worked together to create a semi-scripted show, and I think Tony says it was sort of fly by night scripting, I think is what Tony called it, partially scripted. With a show called Television Library Club, mm-hmm. that David Newell hosted in character as Mr. McFeely from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And they produced 8 episodes, mm-hmm. and it relied heavily on 2 series that came out of
Maryland.
And one was called Book, Look, and Listen, and one was Spinning Stories. And Tony produced wraparound segments that featured Mr. McFeely. So Mr. McFeely would come on and do an introduction. There was a scrambled word that was the password to get into the clubhouse for Television Library Club, where Mr. McFeely did his thing. They would come back after one of the Maryland shows and do a craft segment. So, you know, what could you build with things that you had around the house? So they made bookends out of shoeboxes, mm-hmm. And they made an airplane out of the styrofoam packages that meat came in. So there was a lot of effort to kind of walk through these craft segments to make sure that they would work. Once they were confident that Mr. McFeely could demonstrate these things, then they would roll tape on it. Then Mr. McFeely would come back at the end after the second Maryland show and do a wrap up. And he would often end the show by saying, "See you at the library," mm-hmm. to encourage kids to visit their library. And there was also an outreach component to this where libraries participated, and hundreds of children in Buffalo and Western New York went to their libraries for Television Library Club. So they would watch the show at home and then go for activities related to the episodes at their local libraries.
It sounds like so much fun, and it's not just the focus on literacy. This sounds like Maker Faire as well. Yeah. So it's not just having, you know, this one little thing, but it's like now we're branching out, and what a fun way to get kids interested and reminding them that it all is going to come back to reading, but there's other fun things that we can do, you know, craft wise or just, you know, using your imagination to build.
Right. Right. And the Maryland shows were reading focused. They were 10 minute episodes. So, and this was a show that was picked up by the Eastern Education Network. So it wasn't just Buffalo. There were 15 stations in the Eastern Education Network that also were broadcasting this during the summer. It was an experiment. Could television be used to engage kids in reading? And is this a model that could somehow work with outreach as well? And could it, you know, it was one of those experiments. And while this was going on, and this was summers of 1981 and 1982, Tony was continuing to do the work to build on a proposal for what would be Reading Rainbow.
Yes, and in fact, I had a lot of committees, and at one of the committee meetings, we're struggling with things like what Reading Radar was doing and other ideas. Like, so we developed an idea, and it was actually University of Buffalo professor, as we're kicking this around, said, "Why?" Bill Eller was his name. He was also president of the International Reading Association at that time. He pretty much said, why don't we do what television does best? Why don't we just motivate children to read? Let's just motivate them to read. And he said, I'll show you a better reader. And that became our theme. That was our motive. And as Barb said, at this time, we're thinking about a series. And I actually wrote up a format that I thought would be good for a proposal that we submitted to CPB in 1981. It was called Reading Rainbow. I had an intern that I assigned some material to, you know, like most teachers do with an intern, assign them something. And Debbie Dennis came back with the idea of, you know, reading is like the pot of gold at the end of a rainbow. And so she called it Reading Rainbow. So I said, oh, okay, we'll go with that. I wanted to have a good host, like I mentioned before. The other part was good literature, you know, good children's books, select some good books. I wanted to have a field trip. I wanted it to be a field trip to, you know, television does best, go out in the field and do something and bring it back. Well, our producers even did better than that. They went on location. And then the fourth part was pretty much children, kids telling other kids what books they like, just like, you know, the adults do. And that became the book review segments. So we did not get the grant that year, but they did give us the opportunity to do a pilot, which is what we did. We got some money, about $135,000. We got $60,000 from Kellogg and $60,000 from Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and produced a pilot with LeVar Burton. I found LeVar Burton. Maybe that was the first part of my format. Find a good person. We found LeVar Burton.
And Tony, how, you know, we talk about the importance of that. What was that process like, knowing that you've got this great concept, this great product, but having to choose the right voice to share it? I'd love to hear about that process.
The right person. That was more of a Cecily Truitt and Larry Lancet production people in New York City. First of all, I've tracked Cecily Truitt through Studio C. Wonderful producer, and her husband is a producer director. So I got to give them a lot of credit for finding LeVar Burton. We saw LeVar Burton in Buffalo, and what was it, February 19th? We had the blizzard of 77 when he was Kunta Kinte and Roots, and a lot of people knew of him. And it's kind of interesting because it didn't occur to me, other than the fact that they sold a lot of books when that program was being produced. Of course, people were watching it, especially in the Buffalo area. I mean, we were in bars and schools and cafeterias and wherever. So that kind of struck with me. And then his name came up. And Barb, I think you know more about this because you wrote more about the finding of LeVar.
Yeah,
You just said that.
Yeah. So there were a lot of names that were tossed around. And this was, as Tony said, in the hands of the production team in New York, Lancet Media. And nothing was jumping off the page at anybody. Mm-hmm. And so one of the assistant producers, Lynn Ganick, called up Cecily one night and said, hey, I just saw that LeVar Burton's going to be on this 5 o'clock news show. Live with Susan Simon is the show. And it was like news magazine kind of show. And LeVar Burton's gonna be on Let's Watch. And Lynn had interacted briefly with LeVar several years prior to this when she was a teacher and took a group of students to a PBS conference at which LeVar Burton spoke, among other people. And she noticed that he was like a magnet with the kids, you know, like they were just all gathered around him afterwards talking with him. And that memory kind of got tucked away. So she said, let's watch LeVar on this, do this interview. And so he was in New York preparing to leave the country to go on a whitewater rafting trip for American Sportsmen. So that's why he was in New York, did this interview. Cecily and Larry and Lynn all watched the interview. Cecily called Lynn back and said, we love him, go get him. And obviously they knew him from Roots and they knew him from his other work, but so they just said, go get him. So Lynn contacted his manager, Dolores Robinson. And Dolores herself was at one time a teacher, and LeVar's mother was at one time a teacher, an English teacher. So when this idea came up, LeVar said, it makes total sense to me, right? I like the idea of using television for some positive reason, to do something good. And so he went off to his whitewater rafting trip. Things got worked out between the production team and Dolores. LeVar came back directly from his trip to Africa. Carr picked him up at the airport, took him to the set for the pilot episode of Reading Rainbow. Nobody on the production team had ever met him before. So they welcomed him, and Cecily said, we're so happy that you're here. What can we do for you? Can we get you anything? And she said, LeVar's response was, I would love a glass of orange juice and a toothbrush. So they got those things for him, and they proceeded to tape the pilot episode, and Tony was on the scene for it.
Yes.
Tony, can you talk about that, the magic? I mean, what a great story leading up to this. Here he comes from the airport, and now he's here. That must have been lightning in a bottle, that first episode. Or am I going down the wrong path? Was it a little more difficult than what I'm imagining in my head?
You know, it's interesting. None of us met him. None of us met him before this. I didn't meet him. I knew about him. I knew we were going after him. I got in touch with the writer of the Gila Monster Meets You at the Airport was the book for the pilot. I got in touch with the writer and Ellen Schechter. And obviously a lot of this program's success is because of the writers and the format that we have. She wanted to know a lot, and she got in touch with him prior in somehow, some way, just to know a little bit of how he spoke and how he talked now, and wrote obviously for him. And I was there on the set. It was like 6 o'clock in the morning on a city in New York, in the city of New York. And I was able to introduce myself and small talk, get out of his way. He's ready to do this. And of course I stood off to the side, and when he did the opening scene, I knew that we had our Mr. Rogers. He was just, I don't know, there's a certain amount. He talked to the camera. It's kind of a new thing for him, too. I mean, it was quite, and we had some research. I don't know, Pam, if you're familiar with the research that was done with Chris Dwyer about the pilot.
Well, I mean, a little bit, you know, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting as a funder of the pilot would very much insist upon the idea of doing formative research. So before a whole series gets built, you know, do foundational research to see how the kids and the teachers would react to the elements of the pilot program. And that's a very desired typical trait in a lot of educational television programs that are part of public media. And I would say that Reading Rainbow producers and CPB were really ahead of their time in terms of dedicating some funds to see, okay, make that show. Let's see how these different segments really work. You know, what are the kids paying attention to? Are they, how are they tuned when LeVar's up? What are they thinking of that treatment of the children's picture book? You know, how are they doing with the field trip? What attention, what things do they understand? What do they not understand? And also just appeal. Can you tell how they're responding to the features, the segment ideas of this show? Because, you know, Reading Rainbow was the first ever literacy series focused on books and was doing it in such a way that it was a magazine style program. And the feature book was sort of the launch pad for everything that would occur in each and every episode. So getting that pilot right was going to be really important. And the group that did the research is called RMC Research. And they were an established group, and they're in business still 40 plus years later. And, you know, they served the producers and the project really well. And Barb has some great details too, of just things they discovered about what kids liked or didn't like. And actually Gila Monsters Meet You at the Airport did not become episode one. It got tucked in the first season, a little later in the lineup of shows, because it probably needed a little more work, and they figured out what it needed and they made it better. But they, you know, the producers and PBS wanted to launch with a different opening show, which was Tight Times.
Yeah. And that research on the pilot was, it found a couple things that were very interesting. And first of all, was LeVar Burton was someone that children were very attentive to. So they literally graphed they were observing children as they were watching the episode. And they literally graphed the eyes on the screen at different points during the show. And whenever LeVar was on the screen, the children were glued to it. So they knew that there was that connection between LeVar and the children. And they were very conscious of LeVar speaking to the kids, not speaking down to them, not speaking above their heads, but really relating to them. And LeVar said, you know, like, I had to be my 8-year-old self, you know, in communicating with the kids. So, and another thing that was very interesting, because if you watch the series, you know that the when they're showing the feature book, the camera is moving across the illustrations on the page, right? And that was very intentional by the producers. But one of the things that they learned was that kids sometimes didn't realize that it was a book. They thought maybe it was a cartoon.
Yeah.
And so LeVar carrying a backpack and physically taking the book out of the backpack and showing it to the camera became one of the staples of just about every episode, to really drive home the idea with kids that this is a book that we're going to be reading to you. And you can go to your library and you can get this book and read it yourself. So, and that was all research that came from the pilot episode. So those are really important things that they were learning as they were going along. Like, and I think Alan Schechter, the writer, said we were walking the path as we were creating it.
Yeah.
So, you know, and she talked about how daunting it is to create a pilot. because you have nothing to work from, you know? So that was, so that really laid a lot of the groundwork for future episodes.
I think it's fantastic when you bring that up about kids seeing the backpack and pulling a book out, all things that they're probably doing. So there's that familiarity that is instantly there. Right. Like, I do that every day. Well, I can put my books in there. And the panning of the images, I can't remember the name of the show, but it was a PBS program before Reading Rainbow, where it was a gentleman who would sketch in charcoal what was happening in the book. The name is right out of my head, but that's the way
cover. Tony covered instructional TV. John
Robbins cover to cover.
And now all of a sudden, it seems to be so much more. Brought it to life, and it wasn't watching someone draw. Right. It was really drawing us into the book. Just a fantastic way to approach this.
Right. And that was very that was very innovative. I mean, that was really innovative at the time, what you're pointing to.
You know, Pam, you mentioned CPB being involved, and I remember when we were writing up the bigger grant, Mary Seifert of Corporation Public Broadcasting telling us, pretty much guiding us. She was like our angel. You guys probably should get some sort of research in there. And fortunately, I had a friend who I directed. He is a teacher at Niagara Falls, and I directed his American Literature show in Buffalo, which we aired. And he got a job in New Hampshire as the instructional television director there. And I knew he had a grant. So I gave him a call and I said, who did you use for research? And he said, RMC Research. So good enough for him, good enough for CB. So there was a lot of who do you know kind of stuff going on behind the scenes, especially with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and how they were interested.
I would say, one of the things that I think people don't understand is that when a show comes into being and you've received your funding, whether that's a mix of money from CPB, PBS, others, however you've received your show funding or your series funding, PBS assigns you, content manager to work with the producers. And, the producers are kind of brought under the wing of people in public media. And so especially today, maybe a little less so 40 years ago, but there's a real nurturing and a bringing along of the producing team and, staying in close touch with the producers about what they're doing, how they're doing and that kind of thing. So it's really kind of high quality orientation around all the content.
Mm-hmm. How quickly did things grow after the pilot had been produced and it looks like this is going to be a winner? Can we talk about how things really kind of took off?
We in our first year after the pilot, I think we got money for 15 programs to produce. Mm-hmm. So we did those. The second year, I think it was only 5 programs. And it took a little while because we had to actually, Pam, go to a marketplace for stations that were interested, had to put some money into it, I think. And so, we had to kind of keep selling it for a while. I don't think it just became.
Tony will say when the first season was running and seeing the numbers, right, Tony? Of what?
6.5 million people watched.
6.5 million kids families tuned in. Yeah. So seeing that was really important. But also the recognition of a name or the recognition of a type of show, it took several seasons and several years. And it started as a summer series, right? So it became year round a little later, right? So it takes a while. And if you track the Emmys, the first Emmys that started coming for Reading Rainbow, that was several years in. That was quite a few years in.
Yes.
Yeah, what was the feedback like that you got once you had, you've got these 15 episodes, you've got another season coming up of 5. What was the feedback you were getting from the community like?
I think the feedback we got mostly that I remember is from the librarians who knew a little bit about the show, and thanks to Buffalo and New York County Public Library. But the librarians got used to the idea that a kid would come into the library and say, I heard about this volcano show, and the librarian knew it was Hill of Fire. And I got a few comments like that. That was the feedback that I cherished, because kids were coming into the library taking books out.
That's asking for the title that was in the show, right? Literally asking for it.
Yeah, and publishers responded very differently. than they did initially, because initially publishers were reticent to have their books included, because they said, well, if kids are watching TV, they're not going to be reading the books. And then when the numbers started coming in and 6.5 million children tuned into the episodes during the first season, all of a sudden publishers were noticing a major difference in sales. So a book that would sell 5,000 copies prior to Reading Rainbow was now selling 25,000 copies. Mm-hmm. And so it was having a major impact on the publishing world, to the extent that they also started releasing more of their titles in paperback, mm-hmm. because they wanted them to be more affordable to more children.
Right.
So that that was a major impact of the series as well.
And they also put a sticker on the book that was selected as a Reading Rainbow book. I mean, when you think of the book reviews, the kids reviews, there are four books on every program times 150 programs. So that's quite a few books that are out there based on it.
Right. I was gonna say too, public broadcasting is a national local system, right? So, stations all over the country, like WNED, PBS in Buffalo, there are eight, there were nine stations in New York State and Pennsylvania and Maryland. And so, I mean, hundreds of stations across the country. And they typically would have education departments and programmers and all, but the education staff at a local public TV station, so think about that, all across the country, they were ambassadors of Reading Rainbow, and they were helping connect librarians and reading teachers and educators in their community to Reading Rainbow. And it was an easy sell, because people were welcoming the learning about Reading Rainbow and wanting to help their local station. They wanted to use it. They wanted to be a big part of the use of it. And I would say, if you think too, in the time of the history of Reading Rainbow launched in 1983. And if you think about the decade of the 80s and the decade of the 90s, schools all across America have, 3/4 inch video recording machines. And they have 1/2 inch VHS machines. But, it's the school libraries, the school media centers, the school audiovisual departments, they were all wanting to buy Reading Rainbow episodes. So a child could watch it at home. If a TV got rolled into a classroom, you could watch it live. But people responsible for audiovisual and media resources wanted these shows. So Reading Rainbow was benefiting from the broadcast element, but it was also benefiting from the really active engagement in schools and in libraries with media programs. Mm-hmm. And so kids were getting a lot of doses of Reading Rainbow in different ways.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things, as a viewer, growing up and watching, was the other involvement of the involvement of other kids.
Yeah.
Thing, that gives me a little bit more ownership, knowing that, okay, this kid looks just like, he's just like another kid, and he's telling me about these great books. Now I'm more motivated because I'm hearing it from the voice of a child and not an adult. How did that really strike everybody as someone who is a creator of this program?
Yeah, I really, really like that idea. It's so simple. Again, adults telling other adults about it. Why not kids telling other kids? And that's the way we formed it. And Well, unfortunately, we did a lot of those book reviews. Pam was involved with book reviews that we produced at the station in Buffalo, actually, the first few years.
The producers have you know, Tony knew he wanted this as a feature in his early, you know, vision of the of what a series might contain. And then the producers, when they came to Buffalo, you know, they were in season one and season two and season three, you know, kind of figuring out, well, what does a book review contain? How does it work? How do you help a child read a book, express their opinions, get their little sparkle or their little personality to shine through without scripting anything? So the producers created, you know, the model for how to do book reviews. And it became a feature that was in all the shows. But we had the privilege of working with the producers for the first several seasons. So Tony, Barb, and I all had the fun and the joy of like auditions of hundreds of kids at the station, or the producers zipping out in the car to visit a Buffalo school and meet some kids in a classroom and decide which ones might be invited in. And, you know, so Joshua, you like radio, you know, you like talking on audio, and they were looking for those little spark plugs, those little beautiful children who were not so shy and were a little more articulate and willing to express themselves. And those were the kids who were chosen for the book reviews. And it was very special. It was really unique. And we have a lot of folks in Buffalo, you know, who our favorite, or he's our favorite because we know him the best. Let's put it that way. And we do adore him. But Tom Puckett from WBEN News Radio here in Buffalo was literally on the first show as a book reviewer. And and actually, you know, had some fun with us, you know, going to like the press launch event for the first series in New York City at the New York Public Library. So the children of Buffalo were beautifully represented in the series during the first couple of seasons. It was a lot of fun.
And then, well, I'll make sure that we're tagging him in social media.
Right? Yeah, tag him.
I'll text him right after this. Hey, your name just came up on the podcast, Tom. Yeah, Tom was a GR one. We were at the same time.
Probably. Yeah, totally. And he's been such a fan and such a supporter. And he's well featured in our book, and he's well featured in the recent documentary that was made about the history of Reading Rainbow too. So
that's awesome.
Like you said, Josh, you said, you know, these children look like the children that we're watching, you know, all races, all kinds of kids and quirky kids and this kind of kid. So that was a good impression, I think, on the viewers, the young kids.
And Tony, too, when he talks about like the number of book reviews in every show, as much care from the producing staff went into selecting the book review books as went into the feature book, right? So these all high quality children's literature, diverse writers, diverse artists, you know, a lot of thought going into the nature of those books as well.
And then Pam and I spent many an evening delivering those books to kids for the next day. So we know those books, right, Pam?
Yeah.
Now, over the years, you know, it's been mentioned, you know, the accolades did come, where there's dozens of Emmys, a Peabody Award. What did that do for everyone that was involved with Reading Rainbow, as far as not only is this a nice thing to have on the shelf, but this is validation for what we're doing here as a program?
Mm-hmm. Well, the producers, of course, the production people in New York City, that was the red carpet treatment was something. We went to it, Pam went to it, and for us, I mean, that was just really a different and unique situation. For the people in New York, I think that was so important. And for us, too. I mean, that we're proud of the fact that at least I have five Emmys. So, you know, it's a nice thing to have. Being on the red carpet is kind of like another world. And I know the producers really use that as they're going about, you know, talking to other people, getting their foot in the door to interview somebody. That helped a lot, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well. We do have a chapter about the red carpet and beyond in the book. And the beyond part is, I think if you were to ask everybody here, but all the producers and everybody who worked on the show, if you were to say, you know, what did the awards mean to you? What did other things mean to you? I do believe that everyone will say the awards are cool, but they're not ultimately the thing. The thing is what effect did we have on these children? And the other thing that, you know, we expressed, because we in the interviews that were conducted, everyone talked about how no matter where they go, you know, people come up to them, now grown adults, talk to them about the effect that the series had on them, and that was the real meaningful part. And for the station people too, the educational outreach colleagues who worked with Reading Rainbow in the field, the red carpet and beyond also symbolizes, you know, the work that would go on day in and day out in a community in terms of outreach around Reading Rainbow. And there were young writers and illustrators contests, and thousands of kids would write books and submit them because they wanted to be like, you know, the books featured on the show. So many good things were being prompted by Reading Rainbow out in America for kids and in classrooms. And most teachers considered Reading Rainbow like an individual episode, considered it a perfect teaching tool, because, you know, the book launched into a subject. LeVar took you on a great adventure. A child went to see something in the world they may not know about. So it gave them background knowledge about something they knew nothing about. And then that helps fuel ideas and words and meaning. And most teachers just think it was a perfectly crafted episode for teaching. Like, it's just the way an episode works is just how a teacher would ideally like to go about engaging their kids in learning.
And it was the most used television program in classrooms
for about 17 years straight.
In the classroom. So that's perfect what you're talking about, Pam.
Yeah. And the other thing that's that people have told us and that we know is that it didn't appeal just to kids. One of the things that was so great about Reading Rainbow is that, you know, adults love to watch it too. So parents could watch with their children, which is a really positive thing to have happen. And, you know, the producers said they put on their, you know, their 7-year-old kid hats to sit around a table to as they were building these episodes. But it really did have very wide appeal to adults and children.
What was it like writing this book and working together to tell such a fabulous story?
Yeah. Well, we had a lot of fun. The three of us had a lot of fun doing it. We were very conscious of getting to the people who had a hand in this. So that was a little bit challenging to track people down who were working on this 40 plus years ago, and to kind of jog their memories too. But we interviewed many members of the production team. We interviewed LeVar Burton. Our book is about the early history of the series. So we were wanting to go back to the roots and how did this series come to be? And it was a wonderful collaboration. And everybody that we spoke with really looks back on this time in their lives. These were young people, right? These were people who were young in their careers 40 plus years ago, that were involved in the creation and the development of the series. And they say it was the best. It was the best time. And they became family. And they are still, I became friends with some of these people through the process of talking with them and writing the book. And some of these people they're still very close to, they're like best friends with each other. And, you know, Ed Wiseman, who started as an intern, married Orly Berger, who was one of the key people on the production team very early on, and they have a family, and Cecily and Larry are best friends with Lynn Ganick and her husband, and their kids grew up together, and so it really was this very close-knit group of people who
believed
really believed in what they were doing and the importance of it. So it was great to connect with all of them. We had archival materials, historical documents, and we were very, very careful about being able to document everything that we were saying. So and Tony's a great archivist, so he had his collection of files, and then we had access to the files at WNED PBS, going back to the Studio C days. So it was a lot of fun. I mean, for me as a former professor and somebody who just loves the history of media and loves exploring the process of creating television programs, it was just a whole lot of fun to dig into this. And then great to reconnect with Pam and Tony, who both of whom I had worked with in the mid 1980s. So we made a good team, and I think they'll attest that we had a lot of fun doing it, and we did a lot of Zooms, a lot of conversations, and a lot of dividing up of work and pulling a lot of ideas.
We're wordsmithers. We get piles of drafts and everything. You know, yeah. we got a lot of records, and it's terrific. I think the book was a lot of fun to make, and you know, we've memorialized a part of the history. I mean, mm-hmm. the early history, the lead up. To Reading Rainbow was never fully known or documented, and it's really quite awesome to have done that. For WNED, for our city of Buffalo, for the series itself, it's really great to have that part of the history memorialized in a very lovely way, very special way.
Yeah, and we think anybody who grew up watching Reading Rainbow would probably be interested to learn about this very early history. And we talked to people in Buffalo, many of whom don't know that Reading Rainbow originated here. So, it was a lot of fun and important. I think it's a really important series, and it's right up there with Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and. Among the longest running PBS series in history. And it's, I think, important. It the book fills an important void, I think, in the literature. And Tony's part of this, you know, it was very important to have Tony's first person storytelling here and kind of an oral history of what not only about Reading Rainbow but about public television as well.
It's interesting because the most I've ever written was letters to the editor and I always got in there because I was very brief. I would write a letter and I would cut it in half and send it, and I'm sure that they needed a little space they would put in my letters. So this thing, all of a sudden I'm writing what, thousands of words. I have no idea how many words we finished up with, but it was quite an experience for me because I'm not used to writing that many. But there was my oral history. I do remember a lot of 1965 and the materials and instructional television. As I'm typing this and writing this, I'm thinking this is history. I mean,
well, yeah, I would it is. I would say too, I'm not sure that a fan of Reading Rainbow would care about this as much as a person who dedicated their career to public media would care about it. But mm-hmm. it's really the story of public broadcasting in America. It also is that story of what happened for television across time and its educational mission. And it's the story of a station fulfilling its mission to serve its public. And to do it well and to do it based on genuine felt needs. And that's what public media is supposed to do, you know. So for me, it's also that, which, you know, it's kind of a inside story. But it, but anyway, I really am glad that we have done that also.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. Hey, listen, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time and telling this story. As you were talking about knowing the history behind it, I think in a lot of ways, it's just as important as the product that everyone is so familiar with. Mm-hmm. So what a wonderful effort. I wish you nothing but the best with you know, the folks who are going to be picking this up and reading it. And it, Barb, as you mentioned, a lot of people have no idea that this all stemmed right here in Buffalo, New York. And what a wonderful feather to put in the cap of this community to say a program that reached so many families, so many kids, and has done so much for literacy started right here.
And we say Buffalo Reading Proud.
Well, again, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. It's been a pleasure. And I'd love to follow up with you down the road if you'd be interested in coming back on. I would love to delve more into this subject. I know we've had the time that we've had, but I've got a lot more questions and would love to catch up with you down the road.
Sure.
Awesome. Thank you.
For more information about the Reading Revolution, please visit bookvending.com. If you would like to contact us or would like to suggest a guest, drop us a line at readingrevolutionpod@gmail.com. The Reading Revolution is hosted by Josh Gregory, with technical direction from Thomas Crane and David Gagan. The podcast is produced by Jake Blumberg and Connor Russo. The executive producer is Jay Blumberg. Thanks again for watching and listening. We'll see you here again on The Reading Revolution, where literacy matters.